It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. You want a recipe for inventive cooking? Take long, hard winters, add lousy soil, and blend with lots of imagination. Now, you could end up with the cuisine few people know. Today, we talk Scandinavian cooking with Norwegian food authority Andreas Vistad, author of Kitchen of Light. Well, the Sterns are knocking back oyster shooters at Pacific Oyster in Bay City, Oregon. Culinary forager Ari Weinschweig has the tricks to selecting great salami and ham. Calvin Trillin expounds on the little-known bond linking Mogan David with Chateau Lafite. Kitchen detective Christopher Kimball solves the mystery of the dry chicken breast, and then it's garlic powder to die for. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Now sit up straight, Kate. It's time to eat, Pete. Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Get with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, Plato. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills you. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills you. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Sample a taco paco. Have an hors d'oeuvre, Irby. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Mandrake. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta fazula, Cholula. Oh, do have a bagel, Fagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. You get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Now don't make me nag ya, mag ya. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? Eat all my things if they gag ya. Have a frittata, latte. Nibble a kibble, sibble. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Busta, Cher, Chops, Thump. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Steak, Jake, pie, Si, Juice, Brute. When they come to my house. Next Friday night, you're all invited to dance from 8 to 3. All the fishies in the sea are having a ball. It's some affair, they'll all be there from the herring to the whale. They'll turn out to shake a scale in Neptune's hall. Come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the codfish ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, shuffle off to Buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the codfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't can-can like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night. There won't be a hook in sight at the codfish ball. Octopus and albacore, 50 miles away from shore. Tango cross the ocean floor at the codfish ball. Minnows dance the minuet, barracudas pirouette, while the stingray plays his clarinet at the codfish ball. Scottish salmon form a ring and dance the Highland fling.
the music's hot, so the lock stock's hot, and the Halibut is the jitterbug king. Sing it with me now, come along and follow me to the bottom of the sea. We'll join in the jamboree at the cottage ball. Lobsters dancing in a row, a shuffle on to buffalo. Jellyfish sway to and fro at the cockfish ball. Finn and Hattie lead the eels through an Irish reel. The catfish is a dancing man, but he can't like the sardine can. Tuna's trucking left and right, snappers tapping, what a night! There won't be a hook in sight at the cockfish ball. At the codfish ball. At the codfish ball. Da, 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 da,
da. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's a cuisine few people know. Our guest calls it the Kitchen of Light. We're talking the new cooking of Scandinavia with Norwegian food authority Andreas Vistad. Then it's the secrets of shopping for great Parma ham, great Serrano ham, and a dynamite salami with culinary forager Ari Weinschweig. Journalist Calvin Trillin expounds on the wineways of Kansas City and other Venice observations. We have a garlic powder to die for. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll it all out with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, traveling along the coast of Oregon, we found the kind of place that brings a song to every road fooder's heart. It's called Pacific Oyster, and it is, as the name suggests, an oyster processing plant, also a fish market, and, best of all, a place to sit down and eat some of the freshest seafood you'll get in the Pacific Northwest.
So they have a restaurant, too?
I would say it's more of a cafe. Restaurant.
It's right in front of the cases of the fish and the oysters. It's really bare tables, menus listed on the wall, and a very, you know, informal wait staff. But if you like to eat in grocery stores or fish markets, which we do, this is a great place to eat.
What kinds of things do they do?
Kumamoto oysters are offered in shot glasses. You can get, like, say, a half dozen shot glasses, each one filled with a Kumamoto oyster and its juice. You can knock that back. It's just one of the most heavenly, fresh, oceanic tastes you can possibly have. Of course, if you want to, you can dab a little horseradish in there, but I like them absolutely plain.
And an oyster stew, which I love, fried oysters, and an oyster burger, which is four big fried oysters on a bun. And if you don't like oysters, you can get something which is really terrific there, which is a cheesy crab melt, which is fresh crab meat, which Dungeness crab, with Tillamook cheddar cheese melted on it on a croissant, and it is delish.
And Tillamook is sort of on the coast there somewhere, right?
Oh, it's not far from here at all. It's less than an hour away, the Tillamook Creamery. And this is really good, rich, delicious cheese that just goes so great with Dungeness crab.
I think this sounds absolutely dynamite. And so is it open like all day? Can you go there and eat supper?
It's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, closed Saturdays. But you know what else you should get if you stop there is salmon sticks.
Oh, I love those.
Which are like the beef jerky of fish. They're smoked salmon, smoked and then salted, and also, I guess, sweetened. They sort of have a mesquite-like taste to them. But I think, actually, they come in mesquite-flavored, Cajun-flavored, and teriyaki-flavored. And you gnaw on them the way you do with the beef jerky, except they're salmon.
This sounds like something that you can take in the car and stuff.
I mean, oh,
yeah, it's great car food. And in fact, I do think the Pacific Northwest Indians were the ones who originally sort of made smoked salmon sticks. So this is really kind of an indigenous
teriyaki
of the Pacific. Well, not teriyaki flavored or Cajun flavored, but you can get the plain too, and it is delicious.
And I have to say, one of the great things about this place is that when you pull up, the parking lot and all around the parking lot is literally heaped, as high as I am, with oyster shells. They are everywhere.
So you know that they are not dealing with something that's being shipped in a freezer.
No, no, these are caught right here.
You actually see them shucking them when you walk in. You know, so there's no lapse between the shuckers and the eaters.
Is it on the coast? I mean, is it right on the water?
It is right on the water. I mean, when you look out, when you step out of here, it's actually on a kind of a pier that goes right into the water. I mean, the Pacific Ocean is right there, and that wonderful marine smell just kind of permeates the place.
Sounds utterly ideal. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I know beyond a doubt my heart will lead me there soon. Beyond the shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it happened this week. I got a sniff of fall in the air, which, of course, means soup. And I have come up with a great trick for making canned broth taste more like homemade. It takes 15 minutes. You do it in the same pot that you use for your soup. Now, I explained it in a recent edition of our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, but I think it bears repeating. This is what you do. You lightly film the bottom of your pot with a little bit of olive oil. You fast saute some onion and garlic, and then you add about 1.5 cups of dry white wine. And you simmer that down until you only have 2 to 3 tablespoons. It's almost a syrup. And that wine concentrate opens up all kinds of flavors. So you throw your broth in there, and then you make your soup. Now, if you want to get our future strokes of genius, sign up for that newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. We send it out every week, and you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, and shopping information. And the best part is, it is free. So sign up on the website, splendidtable.org. Ari Weintraub sells food. He's one of the forces behind Zingerman's Deli and Mail Order in Ann Arbor. Ari is also one of the food world's outstanding foragers. His first book is Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating, How to Choose the Best Bread, Cheeses, Olive Oil, Pasta, Chocolate, and More. Ari, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I am just fine. You know, I think that I'd like to talk to you about cured meats. What do we need to know about buying things like prosciutto and salami?
Well, of course, there's a lot to know. And, I've been studying it for a long time now, but I feel like I still barely know just the beginnings of what I want to learn. But I think probably the most important thing to me to understand is to get it in context. And I think the best way I know to do that is to think of it really more like cheese. Because I think we've all come to realize that, you know, every town in Europe and now increasingly here in the States, you know, has its own local cheese, and each cheese has got its own character, its own flavor, its own history, its own culture, and those are really, you know, what make it such an inviting and exciting eating experience. And it's also true of cured ham and of cured salamis. The tendency in my experience here has been to sort of think of prosciutto di Parma as, you know, the only ham that there is, or maybe now jamon serrano has, you know, come on the market, mm-hmm. which is great. But the truth is, if you go to Tuscany, you'll find regional small production hams from there, really from every part of Italy or France or Spain. You'll find little regional variations, and that's how I try to look at it.
Well, let's talk specifically, though, about prosciutto di Parma and then the Serrano ham, because those are two that are out there. Yep. How do you evaluate a good one?
Well, you know, certainly tasting in the end of the day is the biggest thing. But I think in terms of backing up from there, there's really no such thing as not good prosciutto di Parma. I mean, all of it is certainly at a quite a high standard. However, that said, as a baseline, there's definitely variations from one producer to the next and from one ham to the next. A couple things that I look for. One is if you can find somebody who's slicing off the bone, mm-hmm. which means that they've left, you know, the bone in the ham and they're slicing by hand. Those to me are generally going to be better. And that's really primarily because the ham continues to mature with the bone in place. And once the bone has been removed, the maturation and flavor development stop. It's harder to do in the retail setting. The slices don't look, you know, as perfectly beautiful, et cetera, but the flavor is much nicer. So that's really the first thing. Now, there's not a lot of people doing that, but that's definitely one element. A second big element is to learn the age of the ham. The older hams, just like with, you know, more mature cheddars or Parmigiano, might tend to be more flavorful. It's not a guarantee that they're better, but certainly it's more likely. Mm-hmm. And there is, even many retailers don't know it, but there's a little metal rivet up at the top of the prosciutto that will give the date, the month and the year in which it was made.
Now, all of this is true for both hams, right? The Serrano and the Parma ham.
Yep.
Okay.
One of the big things, I think, with both of them is to realize that you really want it consumed as quickly as possible after the slicing takes place so that you're not losing flavor and aroma to the air. I wouldn't buy, you know, a week's worth of prosciutto di Parma and work it down. I would buy it that afternoon to serve that evening for dinner so that you're really getting the true aroma and the freshness of it.
All right. So now let's talk salami. What, for instance, do you have like a top two or three that you love, and how do we buy a salami?
Sure. Well, I again, you know, like with the hams, there's dozens of different salamis out there. And what I like to do from a serving standpoint is to offer two or three or four, you know, different ones of contrasting flavors, et cetera. One of the things that I think I certainly never understood growing up, I mean, salami, like cheese, needs to mature. And well-made salamis from pork should have a nice white mold on the outside. A lot of what's happened in this country is that the mold has been reduced to sort of a white paper. That's not mold, and it's not developing. It's not developing the flavor of the salami. So, it should have a nice white, you know, almost powdery mold that doesn't look dissimilar from that you might see on a mold-ripened goat cheese. And the mold should be sort of alive. It shouldn't be, you know, all washed out. If the salami is too mature, the fat will start to leak out of the salami, and the mold will completely disappear. To answer your specific question, what are two or three that I recommend? There's some really wonderful full-flavored ones that are being made now by Nyman Ranch out in California, where they're using old varietals of pigs, free-ranging Berkshires from Iowa primarily. There's also some nice salamis actually now being imported from France that are under the Jean de France label. And then one of my old favorites, which has been coming into this country for a long time, is the Pick brand salami from Hungary, which again has the natural mold on it and really matures nicely. So it's important to understand there's very few salamis really imported from Europe. Almost everything is still needs to be made here because they don't have USDA clearance to bring it into this country.
So now, all right, so mold good, leaking fat bad, and try those, and thank you.
My pleasure.
Ari Weintraub is co-owner of Zingerman's Deli and Mail Order in Ann Arbor and author of Zingerman's Guide to Good Eating. Now, Ari left us with his recipe for Spanish salad of oranges and olive oil, and it uses that great ham we were talking about. Now, you can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the land of gravlax and akavit. Calvin Trillin talks wine and the kitchen detective, as well as open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/supertarget. Most intriguing cooking comes from places where the living is not easy. Places where people spent the last several centuries figuring out how not to starve rather than nattering about the quality of a sauce. One of these places is Norway. Culinary Mecca is not what comes to mind when you think of Norway. That is, until you take a look at a book called Kitchen of Light. It's pure seduction. It's written by one of Norway's leading food writers, Andreas Vistat, and it is the companion book to his PBS series, New Scandinavian Cooking. Andreas Vistat comes to us from Oslo. Andreas, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Lynn.
You know, as I said, Norway is kind of a mystery to us. So what I'd love for you to do is, can you give us kind of a geographic culinary tour? Give us a sense of what the food is.
Well, Norway is a really long country. We start off at 56 degrees north, and then we move all the way up to 71 degrees north, which is pretty much Arctic area. So the climate is quite varied. In the southern regions, we have fairly rich agricultural areas, and the western areas are really a rough, ragged coastline, but with lots of wonderful game and lots of fantastic lamb. And then we have northern Norway, which is relatively barren and a place where people wouldn't have lived had it not been for all the fish. We have the richest cod fisheries in the world, I think, today, and lots of other fish as well. Lots of salmon, of course, that is all over the country.
What characterizes the cooking?
Simplicity. I mean, we didn't have time to move about and make a cuisine as such. It's all about taking the ingredients that nature has given us and doing really as little as possible with them. But some of the methods and some of the things that we do to them are quite ingenious, I think. The use of spices that we got in exchange for our codfish, and of course methods of preserving food like smoked salmon that you all know, and gravlax that some of you may know.
And you know, you mentioned that gravlax is something that is only done in Scandinavia. First of all, I think, why don't you explain for those who may not be familiar with it exactly what it is?
Well, gravlax is, in a way, two things. 700 years ago, gravlax was a way of preserving the salmon. During summer, salmon was plentiful. Actually, there was so much salmon that workers had work contracts stipulating that they wouldn't get served salmon more than five times a week. but, of course, that was during a few short summer months. People had to find out a way of preserving it for winter. And, of course, salt was very expensive at that time as well. So they managed to invent a way of burying the salmon in the ground and preserving it. It's fermented, and it's quite a strange experience, closer to an extreme sport than it is to what you would associate with a normal culinary experience. But throughout the years, this has progressed, and today, gravlax is a very, very simple way of salt and sugar curing salmon. You rub the fish with salt and sugar, and you place two fillets on top of each other, mm-hmm. and you just let it cure in the refrigerator for 2 or 3 days. And it is kind of a cooking process without any heat.
And there's actually a transformation that takes place because it becomes supple and it's so compressed. It's delicious.
Soft and velvety. It's something about the salt and sugar, but there's also a natural process going on, something called autolysis, which means that all the difficult to digest the proteins and carbohydrates are broken down so that the flesh of the gravlax is very, very similar to cooked fish. But still, we didn't lose all that moisture, and you have that softness, which is incredible.
You open your book with you in the northernmost place that is inhabited on Earth. It is an island, as I recall, right near the Arctic Circle.
And it's far, far north of the Arctic Circle. It's almost up there by the North Pole.
And it's ice and snow 12 months a year. Why open a cookbook in a place like that?
Because that is where I had the first kind of real revelation of, is it possible? Is it possible? I went to the most extreme place. There's hardly anything living there. There are a few reindeer, there's the odd polar bear, and a couple of seals. But then I found out that there are visitors every year. Geese, flocks of geese are arriving from northern Africa, where I guess that they could have a fairly good time all year round. And they come up there and they spend their summer holidays there, and they eat the small, you know, the tiny, tiny shrubs and whatever they can find of heather and moss. And well, there's hardly any vegetation, but they manage there. And the soup that I had made with that goose stock was, to me, one of the most unique food experiences I had. And to have it a place where hardly anything grows, where you are actually closer to the North Pole than you are to mainland Europe.
Hmm. You're now working on an interesting project. Why don't you talk about this?
Well, the Kitchen of Light, the book that we are talking about now, I have translated it to my native Norwegian. So I'm telling the Norwegian population about this food, because I think sometimes something good happens when you're, when I was trying to explain to you Americans what our food traditions are and what our modern food traditions are. I think I learned a lot. I learned to look at my country and my cuisine in a completely different way. And now I'm taking that to my fellow Norwegians.
Well, Andreas Vistad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Lynn.
Norwegian food authority Andreas Vistad is star of PBS's New Scandinavian Cooking and is author of Kitchen of Light. Now, he wanted us to have his recipes for spicy gravlax and for mock akavit. It's all on the website, splendidtable.org. Writer and journalist Calvin Trillin sees life and food through a prism all his own. Now, considering the way his mind works, you might say a kaleidoscope all his own. Sometimes you can actually hear the wheels turning.
Before we get on to the question of whether experienced wine drinkers can actually tell the difference between red wine and white, I should probably tell you a little something about my background in the field. I have never denied that when I'm trying to select a bottle of wine in a liquor store, I'm strongly influenced by the picture on the label. I like a nice mountain, preferably in the middle distance. And yes, I did once write in a newspaper column that in a discussion comparing French and American varietals, I was the one who remarked that Chateau Lafite Rothschild and Manischewitz Pink Cream Catawba both tasted rather Jewish. In writing that, I should add, I was only trying to make a little joke. I've never been in a discussion comparing French and American varietals. When I was growing up in Kansas City, I didn't know about people drinking wine at meals that were not being eaten in celebration of a major anniversary. I assume that my neighbors would have been as startled as I to hear about such carryings-on. Years later, after I'd moved to New York, a newspaper man in my hometown did me a great favor, and when I wondered aloud what I could get for him, a friend of mine in New York, a sophisticated friend of mine who considered himself something of a gourmet now that I think of it, said that a case of wine was always appreciated. I phoned the newspaper man's son-in-law in Kansas City to ask if he could find out discreetly what sort of wine was particularly fancied in his in-law's house, and the son-in-law got back to me with a question of his own. Does wild turkey count? Even now, I can't imagine many people in Kansas City, Missouri, routinely opening a bottle of Merlot at dinner time, any more than I can imagine them eating seared Maine diver sea scallops or poached pavé of Arctic char with cider-braced fennel or leek and fava bean risotto. These days I do drink wine more often than the adults I knew in my boyhood did. Still, if I'm in a meal in which drink orders are being given by the glass, I am likely to say to the waiter, "What sort of fancy beer do you have on tap?" I have spent a certain amount of time in the company of wine cognoscenti, but I wouldn't claim that I have distinguished myself on those occasions. Many years ago, for instance, a winemaker I know was kind enough to invite me to the barrel tasting of California wines that used to be held annually at the Four Seasons Restaurant in New York, an event that was considered a very hot ticket in the wine game. At the table, many glasses of wine were put in front of us. Then someone who had his mouth very close to the microphone talked about each wine in what I believe scholars would call excruciating detail. The type of vines that had been grafted together to produce it, for instance, and how long it had been in stainless steel vats or oak barrels. Displaying manners that I thought would have made my mother proud, I drank what was placed before me, not noticing as I glanced around to see whether more food was ever going to appear that everyone else was just sipping. I have since heard two or three versions of what transpired that evening, but they do not differ in whether or not I fell asleep at the table. According to one version, the last polite question I mumbled to my host was, "And then you graft the vines onto the stainless steel vats?" Particularly considering my performance at the Four Seasons that evening, it's perfectly possible that some people asked to sum up my knowledge of and attitude toward wine might respond, "Ignorance, tempered slightly by Philistinism."
A little taste might hit the spot. A little taste might help a lot. It may be nice and maybe not. In my condition, this is a risky proposition.
Journalist Calvin Trillin is the author of the Tummy Trilogy. His latest book is Feeding a Yen. Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine, has set himself up as the Sherlock Holmes of cuisine, with the magazine as his 21 Baker Street lab. Cook's is where the mysteries of cooking are unraveled. They take no advertising and take no prisoners when it comes to perfecting the technique behind a dish. Well, Christopher Kimball's latest book is The Kitchen Detective, a culinary sleuth solves common cooking mysteries. Chris, welcome back to the show.
That was a great intro. I'm going to use that.
Well, I think it's true. Well, all right. I've got a challenge for Sherlock Holmes, though. Every night, somebody in America is opening their fridge and staring at a chicken breast, and they are praying to the gods of cooking that it will not be dry this time. So have you got a solution to the problem?
I've seen these for years. They just throw them in the 400-degree oven for 45 minutes, right?
Well, yeah, something like that, or in the sauté pan.
And you know what happens. Yeah, the skin is greasy. The breast meat, of course, is overcooked, and the whole thing is inedible. That's why they put barbecue sauce on top of it.
Well, this is true, but, I mean, we all suffer from this, the dry breast syndrome. So what do we do?
Well, the first thing is Cook's has often been called the magazine of brining for good reason, because we got onto this years ago back in the 80s for turkey and then expanded our brining skills into chicken and shrimp and pork. But especially for white meat, you do need to brine for most recipes. And that's simply, it's easy. Take 2 quarts of cold water, half a cup of table salt, half a cup of sugar, mix it up, throw the chicken in, and refrigerate for an hour, and you're done. So it's only an hour, and it makes a huge difference because the salt allows the water to be retained in the chicken during cooking. If you just put it in water, it would still absorb water, but the salt helps the retention.
Uh-huh.
And it makes a big difference because even if you overcook the breast meat, it'll still remain relatively moist. So it solves that problem of getting the perfect internal temperature.
So you plumped it up, but what happens when you put the heat on?
Well, actually, that's interesting. We've tested using salt and not using salt. And what happens is the retention is better. And so that means that there's more liquid, actually, after cooking. It's a higher water content.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, of course, you have more flavor because there's a little bit of salt and sugar in there.
Right.
So you actually are flavoring the meat at the same time. But that was just part one. Part two is a classic restaurant technique, which is sautéing something in a pan and putting the pan, whether it's chicken or fish or whatever, in an oven to finish. And what you do is you get the wonderful flavor development and browning in the pan, so that skin gets rendered of its fat and gets nice and crisp. And you turn it over and throw in the oven, a 300-degree oven, 350-degree oven, and you end up another 20 minutes it's cooked, so you solve the problem of flavor development, the skin is crisp, the brining makes the bird moist, and it's a nice combination between stovetop and oven.
Now, can you apply this? So you do a relatively fast brown, and then you stick it in the oven for about 20 minutes, and you've got juicy deliciousness.
You could do it with a tenderloin of pork or pork chops. I do pork chops that way all the time and throw them in a lower oven, mm-hmm. 250 oven. You can even do it with a thick steak if you like, if it's particularly thick. You can do it with fish.
Mm-hmm.
You can saute a piece of tuna or swordfish quickly in a pan for a couple minutes, throw it in a low oven, let it finish. It's the advantage is, especially for certain things, that you have a greater window to know when it's done, like fish.
It
cooks so quickly. You know, if you're a minute off because the phone rings, the fish is overcooked. At least it cooks more slowly and more evenly. So it's a great technique.
Can you use it for the boneless, skinless chicken breast too?
The problem with that is they're usually not thick enough.
Uh-huh.
And so you probably, by the time those things cook so quickly in the pan, you probably, you know, by the time you finish sautéing, it's cooked. You probably could if it's a big, thick piece of chicken. But if it's one of those thinner, boneless, skinless fillets, that'll cook pretty quickly on top of the stove.
So if it's an Arnold Schwarzenegger chicken, you can do it, but otherwise you'd brine and you just do a sauté.
I mean, it's Republican chicken.
Yes.
Yeah, if it's Republican chicken, you got to brine it, right?
Okay. Absolutely. Hey, thanks, Chris.
My pleasure.
Politics aside, Christopher Kimball is the author of The Kitchen Detective. Now, you can find his recipe for pan-roasted chicken with mustard sherry sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week's question is, why was today's culinary darling, basil, not eaten in ancient Rome? That was around then, and they had pesto, but never with basil. So why? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one, where you can have your cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, why was today's culinary darling, basil, not eaten in ancient Rome? Wait until you hear this litany. Eat basil in ancient Rome, and you took your life in your hands. They believed it interfered with eyesight, digestion, and the bladder. Romans thought it caused malaria, liver disease, and madness. Basil made a plague seem almost benign. How about this? Basil attracted scorpions, worms, and it gave you head lice. One medical theory said, eat basil and get stung by a scorpion on the same day and you will definitely die. Now, all this priceless information comes from a book called Around the Roman Table by Patrick Foss. Oh, one other thing. Remember I said the Romans had pesto? Well, they did, but it was made from coriander or other herbs, never basil. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have Joe on the line. So, Joe, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I was down south several years ago, and somebody in my family made some fried green tomatoes, and I have been trying to hunt down the secret to making decent fried green tomatoes for quite some time now. Unfortunately, every time I make them, they turn out pretty gross.
When you say pretty gross, what happens?
They used a mixture of cornmeal and flour and some spices, and they brown up real nice.
Yeah.
But they tend to be on the bitter side.
Uh-huh.
Picking them too early.
I wonder, because one of the problems you run into is mush, because people pick them too late. Maybe you're going too far in the other direction.
Probably.
Yeah, because this is the basic thing. You have about a quarter to a half inch of oil or bacon fat. Now, if you want to really go for broke, that bacon fat is fabulous. But you have that in a big skillet, so it's not deep fat frying.
Okay.
You know, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And some people just dip it in seasoned cornmeal, dip the sliced tomato. Other people will dip it in buttermilk or egg. And then just dip it in cornmeal,
okay.
But fry it on the slow side. You know, they'll have the fat hot enough,
okay.
But they might fry it 2 minutes to a side. Now, are you doing it that long?
It might be even longer because I tend to go low on the oil and pretty a little longer. So.
Okay, I think maybe, first of all, do a little more oil.
Okay.
But you're saying the tomatoes are actually bitter.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if it's the tomatoes or if it's the coating.
I don't think it's the coating.
Okay.
I think it's maybe that you need tomatoes that are just a tad further along. But be careful. If they're starting to show any color, they might be getting a little bit too soft inside.
Okay.
So you want them to be firm, and I'd say you cut them about between a quarter and a half inch thick.
All right.
And dip them, do the dip. Why don't you try the dip with the buttermilk and then cornmeal that has salt and pepper in it.
That sounds great.
And see what happens. But get that fat pretty hot. It shouldn't be smoking.
Okay.
But when you drop a piece of bread into it, it should start to brown.
Okay.
That's how you would test it.
Exactly.
Hey, Joe, thank you.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for the Aligo recipe several weeks back.
Isn't that fun?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's great.
One of the nice things that can happen to a potato.
Oh, I know.
You take care.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
The aligot recipe that Joe was referring to, which is up on the website, by the way, it's from central France, as I remember. I think the Auvergne region of France. And it's where you whip potatoes with cheese. It's just wonderful. A little more wintry than summery, but it's fabulous. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who is up next. We've got Charlie calling. Charlie, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question about barbecue. More to the point, drinks to serve with said barbecue. I have barbecued competitively in the past with the KCBS, the Kansas City Barbecue Society.
Huh.
And it's just a hobby of mine, and I've served for friends and such. And of late, I've had a few people ask about wine to serve with that barbecue.
Is that sort of a violation of code for someone who is what sounds like a semi-pro barbecue competitor?
I would think so, yes.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, I wonder if it's viewed as being rather effete.
Well, yeah.
Instead of the beer. Okay. This goes back to our wine guy, Josh Wesson, and he has this great idea, and it's dynamite. It's you match the wine to the sauce, you know, to the main flavor.
Right.
Of the barbecue. So most now let me ask you, does your barbecue have sort of a sweet, spicy undertone?
Well, mine, I grew up in Memphis, so I have a mixed style that is partly Memphis style and partly Kansas City style. The vast majority of the flavor of my barbecue does not come from sauce. Most of my stuff is served dry.
Okay, but it's smoky, right?
Right.
Okay,
yes.
I think I've got a solution for you. You want a real fruity red, like a Merlot, okay? And you don't have to spend a fortune. I'm thinking brands like Hogue and Pepperwood, all right?
Okay.
Now, if you have a slight sweet undertone anywhere, you can go to the whites, even though it's red meat, and you can go to things like Riesling, Chenin Blanc, and then my all-time favorite, I swear, my all-purpose wine for the past 3 or 4 months, because it works with spice and it works with smoke and it works with sweet, is this blend of Chenin Blanc and Viognier. I know it sounds fancy, but just remember Pine Crest. It's made in California and it's not wildly expensive. And that, and you know, if you put that in a beer glass or you just hold, you know, the glass in a paper bag, nobody is going to know.
All right.
Hey,
thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Now, I understand the problem with wine and barbecue, and I know it probably goes against the grain of some people, but between you and me, it's dynamite. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have Lan Chi on the phone. Hey, Lan Chi, welcome.
Hello, Lynn. Thank you. I have a question for you. Could you please show me how to crack, show me the way to a gentle way to crack open a coconut?
Dear Lunchy, I don't know a gentle way of doing it. But I know a way that's pretty safe. In fact, it comes from a book that's actually called Cracking the Coconut. It's about Thai food. Mm. I'll tell you the way I do it, okay?
Okay.
First of all, to get the water out of the coconut, which is what you hear sloshing around, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have a screwdriver and I have a hammer. I know none of this is gentle, but that's a really hard shell. And I steady it on a pile of towels, you know, so it's not going to slip. And I actually just, you know, those little indentations on the top of the coconut.
Yes.
I'll actually pound that screwdriver through two of those, pour off that water. And you know, you can freeze that if you're not going to use it right away, but it's lovely to drink iced. It's so good. And then what I do is I bake the coconut at 325 for about a half hour in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
And then put it down on the ground, you know, someplace where I can't do any damage, but in a nest of towels so it doesn't move around. Mm-hmm. And I just whack it with that hammer.
Okay.
How have you been doing it? Have you tried it?
I use a hammer and I use the knife, the chef knife, and I chip a lot of blades.
Yeah, so, you can't. You're going to ruin the chef's knife. This is why you want a screwdriver. But if you bake it, it helps make, I think it just makes that shell a little bit more brittle and it tends to break apart more easily. And then you use the screwdriver also to pry the flesh away from the brown shell.
Mm.
Now, one thing too is when you do it, do a lot of them because you can put every bit of it into the freezer. And that way you're not, you know, when you sit down to make something where you want nice fresh coconut, you're not going to have to go through this.
Yeah.
Hey, Lan Chi, thanks for a great question. I think a lot of people want to know how to do it.
Well, thank you for your splendid solution.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us at 800-537-5252. Okay, guys, we're in that last breath of warm weather, the last corn. It's time for the last great corn feed. And for my money, for the first and the last corn of the season, you want to do it straight. You want to just boil it for about 2 or 3 minutes. You want to eat it with salt or slather it with the best butter you can lay your hands on. But let me give you a tip. I mean, I realize it's a little late in the season, about how to hold corn. When you get the corn home, dampen paper towels and lightly wrap several ears. Put several ears per paper towel and put it in a plastic bag in the fridge. That extra moisture is going to help the corn stay moisture, and it's going to help it keep sweetness. It keeps everything fresh around it. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Judy calling. Judy, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My husband and I went to Spain this summer, and we were at this restaurant, and, you know, they serve gazpacho in all sorts of guises.
Right.
This particular gazpacho was a smooth gazpacho, but it had with it what they called helado de aceite, ice cream, oil ice cream.
Huh.
And we thought, oh, this sounds weird.
Right.
But it was just a melon ball size, and it was absolutely exquisite. It's made with olive oil and sugar,
right,
and some eggs, and it has a very sort of slightly sweet flavor, a slightly olive oily flavor,
right,
and it,
right,
is exquisite. And so we wanted to make that, and we actually did find a recipe online, but it calls for something called, in Spanish, trimoline, and in English, trimoline. And all I can find out about trimoline is that it's something called inverted sugar. Do you know what this is?
I think I do. It's inverted sugar is, I've heard it's a blend of something like fructose and glucose.
Mm-hmm.
It's a product of sugar sometimes that's produced from starches. And I think it's a very thick syrup, and it's used commercially. It's not something that generally, you know, the home cook uses. But what occurs to me is that there is, there are websites that deal with the trade. And I think one of them is called Chef Pro or Pro Chef, and another one, it just got started by the French Culinary Institute in New York. If you go online and go to the French Culinary Institute of New York, you will find this new website, and it's for pastry pros as well as amateurs, pastry embracing desserts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you may be able to find more information about it, but what I think it is, it's like a thick, clear glucose syrup.
Would it be like our Karo syrup?
It might be, and it also might be like our clear corn syrup. You know, Karo syrup is corn syrup.
Uh-huh.
But you know, when you're talking about, by the way, that's ice cream sounds,
yeah,
like it echoes way back to the Arab domination of Spain, which began like in the 900s.
Huh.
That idea of making ices and that idea,
uh-huh,
of using,
uh-huh,
olive oil and sugar.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering if you could, you know what, why don't you try it with clear corn syrup and see what happens? Do a small batch of it.
Well, I could.
Yeah.
I could. Then we can maybe surprise our friends with some oil ice cream.
Oh, they're going to be they're going to be kissing the hem of your apron. Come on. Hey, great question.
Hey, thank you. I enjoy your show. Great.
Thank you. Take care. 800-537-5252. That's how you reach us. You know, it's a great gift to have passion, whether it's for cars, cooking, or garlic powder. That's right, garlic powder. Now, don't turn up your nose. A little booklet on how to make your own may open your mind. The booklet is called The Complete Guide to Making Great Garlic Powder, and it is written with such belief and such passion that I decided I have to talk to the author. He is Herrick C. Kimball, an organic garlic grower in the Finger Lakes region of New York State. Herrick, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Hi, Lynn. It's my pleasure.
So how do you make your own garlic powder?
Well, you want to start out with some really good garlic. It takes great garlic to make great garlic powder. And in the grocery store, when you buy garlic powder, it's made with soft neck varieties of garlic, which are grown predominantly in California and some in China.
Mm-hmm.
And the soft necks are, there's nothing wrong with soft necks, I should say, but they don't have the reputation for flavor that the stiff neck varieties of garlic have. Stiff neck garlic is often referred to as gourmet garlic because it is so flavorful. And when you make garlic powder from stiff neck varieties of garlic, you end up with something that most people in the world have never experienced before. The remarkable flavor of the stiff necks doesn't disappear when you dry the garlic and dehydrate it. It kind of concentrates, and the powder takes on a personality that is really unique.
Huh. So you just dry the garlic. What do? You slice it first, and then you grind it?
Yes. You take the garlic bulbs, and
right.
you break them apart,
uh-huh.
and you want to peel them,
uh-huh.
and then you slice them. You can slice them by hand, but a food processor works a whole lot better. And then you layer them in your food dehydrator, and you dry them until they're dry, until when you bend them, they don't bend, they break. And then you grind them in your garlic grinder, which is nothing more than a blender. And you fill the blender about half full, and you hit, usually blenders have a grind button.
Right.
And the chips will, in very short time, you'll have a whirlpool of freshly ground powder. And it's wonderful. If people will make their own garlic powder, they'll never want to try store-bought again.
Well, I have to tell you, I have a sample of your garlic powder, and everybody loves to turn up their nose at it, but I thought, let's taste it on the air, and let's see. I have not had it before.
Oh.
Okay, so taking off the lid, it looks just like, first of all, it's like little granules in there and
it's
powder.
It's a texture to it. Yeah.
Holy cow, the aroma is pure, intense garlic. Okay, a taste? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, holy. Well, woo. I love it. That's real garlic. Okay,
very
I'm
garlic.
A convert. I'm actually liking garlic. Boy, it's sharp, too.
It is sharp. It's got some attitude to it.
That it does. Hey, Herrick, thanks so much.
Okay.
Garlic powder. Thank you. Herrick C. Kimball is an organic garlic farmer in the Finger Lakes region of New York State, and he's author of The Complete Guide to Making Great Garlic Powder. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And remember, call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this observation from Anonymous. Garlic is the ketchup of intellectuals. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Just about everything you heard today and other titillating information can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You can also find our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. You register for it online at splendidtable.org. And by the way, it has a new look. So for those of you who have already registered, check it out. Let us know what you think. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetti Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.